I am so glad you could join us. I'm your host, Mo Gaudat. This podcast is nothing more than a conversation between two good friends sharing inspiring life stories and perhaps some nuggets of wisdom along the way. This is your invitation to slow down with us. Welcome to Slow Mo. Welcome back. My guest today is a rock star, an actual rock star, who's also a very, very, very dear friend. She played bass with rock and metal legends, including Twisted Sister, Guns N' Roses. She's the bass guitarist of Whitesnake, and she's now playing with Bruce Dickinson of Iron Maiden, my second favorite band of all time. Used to be my very top band of all time until I got too much into Pink Floyd. But still, I mean, second favorite band of all time. And she's touring to play the music of John Lord of Deep Purple across the world with Bruce Dickinson and a very large orchestra, an amazing, amazing bass guitarist. The way we met is, let me be very clear to start. Crying in the Rain is in my top 10 songs of all time. Crying in the Rain by Whitesnake. If you don't know Crying in the Rain, then you're either a little too young, or you wasted your life listening to Madonna and Modern Talking and all of that. Don't judge you for it, but you know, you could have done better. So I was listening to Crying in the Rain, walking through my Instagram messages as always, and I found a very articulate message, actually a long message, very well thought, from someone who listened to my conversation with Stephen Bartlett and decided to text me about it. So I answered back. I actually look at the profiles of everyone who texts me so that I can establish a bit of a human connection, sort of, before I answer. And I was like, oh, that's wonderful. So you're in a tribute band to Whitesnake. And she responded and said, no, actually, I'm Whitesnake and I'm about to go on stage. And I said, you're shitting me. In better words, but basically that's what I said. So she sends me back her photo with the badge and her bass guitar. And now I'm searching. I'm like, is this really Tania O'Callaghan? And yes, it is. And Tania is truly, I don't know if I can say that, but I don't know many others, is my favorite rock star in that she is not a rock star. Fully. So she's a, I don't know if it's a, she's a fake one, but she's the one that does yoga before the concert and drinks soda water instead of beer on stage. And then when it's the party time, she goes out and walks alone to discover the cities that she's in, very down to earth. And you know, as we do here on Slow Mo, I rarely, let me put it this way, I host celebrities when they have something to say. And the first time I met Tania O'Callaghan, basically I asked her, so why do you do all of this? And she said, the music is my entry, is my passport to making the world a better place. So yes, we will talk a little bit about music, but we will also talk about making the world a better place with one of my dearest friends. And yes, I bow in respect to my, like a fanboy, Tania. Thank you so much for joining
me. What an intro.
Yes, it is from the heart, isn't it?
You made me remember. I remember I was going on stage in the O2 in London when I sent you that. And you were like, oh, that's nice that you're in a tribute band. And I was like, no, I'm in White Snake. And you're welcome to come to a show.
Yes, I remember that you said that. And the thing is, I've tried, we always miss each other. We're going to miss. Yeah, it's not fair. Life is not fair that way. You're playing in Rio.
I'm playing in Rio like 2 days after you. 2 days before,
yeah. 2 days before I arrive, yeah. And I'm like, okay, you know what?
You should just come early.
Exactly, come early. But then my daughter's here, and I'm going to ask my daughter if I can take her with me to Rio.
Absolutely.
Right? So for people who don't know John Lord was the keyboardist of Deep Purple. And if you've ever heard Burn,
exactly.
You know what kind of a musician this was. I mean,
phenomenal.
Yeah. Phenomenal. I think among all rock keyboardists, probably.
And really who also brought that to the forefront was like rock keyboards.
Yes.
Phenomenal. absolute like musical genius.
Absolute genius. And he was composing a lot of the music, right? No?
I mean, yeah. But what's really unique about this tour as well, and we were all wondering how it would go down, because it's literally like the first half of the show is a concerto. There's three movements.
And I
it's
love
an
that.
82-piece symphony orchestra, and you have Iron Maiden fans in the front row, like, disciplined, waiting for like, when's Bruce going to sing? And it's really fun because it brings this whole other level to, you know, people sitting patiently, really listening to this phenomenal music, because you have to wait till the second half until it turns into a rock show.
Yeah.
So it's been really special because they wanted to put together like an all-star band and really tribute the music. And it's like nothing I've ever done before. And that's why I said yes, because it makes no sense for anybody for all the other reasons. But like, you can't not do the John Lord, you know, concerto for group and orchestra with Bruce and all these great players. So it's been something totally different. And the response so far has been phenomenal because people are patiently waiting through a concerto and discovering that they like
They like it,
and they're like, this is rad.
Do you remember Apocalyptica, which were four cellos that played Metallica music and so on? I have to say, the first time I heard them, I was like, that's an interesting mix. But it also highlights to you that there are lots of melodic complexities to rock and metal that most people don't understand, right? And it really is, when people tell me there is so much, you know, that rock or metal music is a lot of noise, I'm like, I don't think you understand. I really don't. And I honestly believe that it's the best lyrics on the planet. It's definitely the most felt, you know. It's not about shaking your booty and, you know, and it's really deep.
No,
I mean, Bruce Dickinson sings in The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. This is Charles Dickens, wasn't it?
Or, he does a lot of that.
Yeah, it's really quite something, you know. And I think the idea that people would go to a concert that has that is quite interesting. But the thing is that not a lot of people know John Lord.
No, it's like the real musos do and the real Deep Purple, like hardcore Deep Purple fans. But that's also what's so interesting, because people know the hits, you know, they know that when you come out, everybody sort of knows like Smoke on the Water and all this and Hush, and the keyboard guitar centric people know Burn or whatever.
Do you play Burn?
Well, when is this coming out? Because I can reveal that we were going to, but if you don't put it out, we actually just added it, because it was one of the things that I said upon initially saying yes to doing the tour. We have to do Burn.
We have to do
so Burn. Everybody in this lineup is related to Deep Purple in 1 or 2 degrees of separation. That's what's particularly, so obviously I play with Whitesnake, David was Burn album.
That's true, of course. Yeah.
And Bruce knew John very well, and he is actually on the recording of the concerto as well. Mm-hmm. Our amazing maestro conductor, Paul Mann, has been with Deep Purple since he was a kid. His uncle was their one of their road crew, and he's been doing the live orchestras, but it's so funny to watch, because again, it's just like people are waiting for the hits, but then understanding that they also love and are getting this newfound appreciation for the concerto and the musicality of it and what John Lord actually was. So it's pretty amazing. And we are adamant. The thing that's hard about this tour is, unlike Apocalyptica or bringing out a string quartet or something like that, this is an 82-piece symphony orchestra. It's like, don't cut any corners. It's a full-on orchestra. It's not a cut-down, stripped-back orchestra, which most rock shows would do, because it's not logistic at all to have a full harmonic. But that's what makes it. The sound that comes from them is just phenomenal. And every night, I was hearing different things. I'm like, oh my God, I didn't hear that before. Oh my God, I never heard that oboe part. Oh my God, I didn't know that the percussion section did that. So it's
so what do you take the same 82 people with you everywhere?
No, you can't. That's the only one of the logistic problems with this. I mean, you can if the budgets are through the roof, but that's a lot of people, and you're working with orchestra unions, which is really unusual. So they have to work certain hours. Rock musicians are just used to like, right, let's go, and you can go run for as long as you want, rehearse for as long as you want, whatever. So we had, for the European tour, we had like the Zagreb Philharmonic for 3 or 4 shows, and then we switched. We had a different orchestra in Romania, and we had a different orchestra in Czech Republic. And so you usually can only use them for a certain territory, because it's just too hard to travel with that many people.
And then you have to rehearse with everyone?
Yeah, you do.
Because, oh, man.
Yeah, you do, which is really interesting for us, because it's not normal. Like, we do full on. Like, we've been doing, you know, from 9 a.m. until 9 p.m. because you're doing broken times because, again, of unions. So it's really interesting because you're back in your first band. You're like, I got to play all day. I'm used to showing up to the venue for, you know, my tech has everything done and I walk on stage. But it's lovely because it's the music takes a lot of focus and concentration, the concerto part of it.
I know.
So it's not like just learning normal songs.
Yeah.
There's a lot of focus involved because these pieces are up to like 18, 19 minute long and the band is coming in and out on sections. So you really have to know where you are. Yeah. So it's been a journey, a musical journey. And I think you should come to Rio early because
I'm now like telling myself what else is more important. Like what else is
Yeah, I already gave you a backstage pass.
I know I have a signed backstage pass, by the way. So so that's you know, that's the perk of knowing the bassist. But but yes. So Tanya, how does one become a rock? I mean, I played guitar when I was young to impress the girls. Every geek does that. You know that, right? It's quite interesting because, you know, my life actually took a full circle, and you know, which is really, really eye-opening, because when I was younger, as a geek and a good boy, I was always a good boy, very respectful. I opened the door to my, you know, to my girl and whatever. And of course, girls in teen and 20s didn't like good boys. They wanted the bad boy. And so I tried harder. Like every time I was rejected, I would try harder. So I played the guitar, I composed music, and I did really well. I really, really got the entire crowd of girls around me whenever we were going on a trip anywhere, leaning on their bad boys. So, you know, it's like, what the F, really?
A global phenomenon.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, I'm playing here. Why is everyone with their bad boys? Anyway, but I never made it to rock stardom. You can obviously understand maybe that I wasn't supposed to. I think you were not expecting that either.
I would never have guessed. Never. In my, I wouldn't even say wildest dreams because it wasn't a dream of mine. I would never have guessed that this is where I would have ended up. Because I only picked up a bass when I was 17 or 18.
It is
was
that true?
Very late, yeah. I was always interested in music. So I was always listening to music. My dad's big into music, so we had a great vinyl collection. So I think when I was a kid, subconsciously, I was hearing all the good stuff. But there's like, no, I have two cousins, one on either side that play music, but there's no musicians in the family. There was no signs at all because I was just an animal fanatic since my first memories. And I spent 10 years working at a rescue shelter, and it was pretty apparent that I would be either like a vet or run the shelter, or I took an interest in like marine biology at one stage, but it was like, she's definitely going to work with animals for sure. Mm. And then I picked up a bass and oops, like the rest is
that works.
Yeah, it's bizarre. I really didn't plan, and I'm completely self-taught. It wasn't a thing that, you know, let me go get trained as a musician.
That was the beginning of YouTube having lots of videos and so on, where you can be self-taught very, very well.
Yeah, but I didn't even have that.
Oh, you didn't?
No, because like I'm from a small town in Ireland. It's not that we were that behind, but I'm also like, I'm the opposite to you. I'm a total technophobe. Like, God love me, I can barely send an email. Thankfully, I have a team with Highway to Health because I'm really good with people and in person and solving problems with tech stuff. So I think, like, I just remember having Napster and like the slowest dial-up internet on the planet in my hometown. So I would come home from school, try to download an album that I wanted to listen to or learn, go downstairs, eat dinner, watch something, come back up, and it's still downloading.
I know.
So the way that I learned was, so I joined bands really, really fast. I was like in my first band within 6 weeks of playing bass. I think this is kind of what the crucial thing was when I look back. That became my teacher. My cousin had a heavy metal band called Severed. We were total rebels. I was only just playing bass, and they needed a bass player. So it's like, bass, here you go. We're in drop C, which is really, really low for anyone. Actually, we're in drop C sharp. Anyway, we need a bass player, so you have to play. And it was that going, okay, and diving in. I was immediately playing.
Oh, that's incredible.
And I'm learning from tapes. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, kind of shows tape, not even a CD, and you're like putting the tape in and rewinding it and trying to hear. And I was doing everything by ear. And then not long after that, I joined a corporate wedding band. So you're doing like, you know, top 40 hits. And I was always the worst player in the band by a mile. So I was chasing professional players and their skill set. So I think when I look back, that's what got me so deep into learning so fast, because I was always having to learn songs. And I kind of realized early, I was like, hey, if I'm in loads of different bands and playing with loads of different people, this is really good. And then when you have to be on stage, which I did not like at the beginning, I was like, oh, I don't know what I'm doing up here. So I was just, I just dove in like crazy fast into performing, into being in multiple bands. And by the time I was playing like 3 years, I was in 7 or 8 bands at a time.
No
so
way.
I was like a lunatic. I just was in everyone who needed a bass player. I was like, I'll do it. I'll do it. I'll do it. It was like duos, trios, you know, pop things, heavy metal, you know, singer songwriter, you name it. I was trying to put it together. I was trying to obsessively organize like different bands because I wanted to see if I could be like a session musician.
Yeah.
I thought everyone says you can't make a living in music. I was like, as soon as somebody tells you you can't do something.
So as soon as someone tells you,
well, maybe that's a personality trait. Okay.
Yeah.
So basically, that's the long and short. Like, I was in bands really fast. And then I did go to music college for a very, very brief stint where I went to a place in Dublin that I kind of accidentally got into, mm-hmm. which is funny because I dropped out of school. I always did really well. And part of my dropping out was kind of a system moment as a rebellious teenager because I was so curious. I am a curious person and I love to learn. But it was just so, the system, as it still is for a lot of people, doesn't suit different types of learners.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And I'm in an all-girls Catholic Irish school in mm-hmm. rural Ireland, and you have to learn this, this, and this. I'm like, what I really want to do, you know, I want to do stuff in whatever it was, like woodwork or music. I want to play drums. They're like, no, you can only play violin or piano. You know, you only have these languages to choose from. You can only choose from these science subjects. And I wanted to just learn so much more. Mm. So I left. And I went to do a music course, and that's how it all started. So I was there for a moment. That's when I joined the bands. But it's mad because it was all these moments of realizing I don't want to. It's the same when I was a little girl and I realized what meat was. My gut instinct went, don't waste any more time on that. Go here. Don't waste any more time on that. Go here. And so far, it served me well in life. But to your original question, I had no idea I would become. So I don't know how you become a rock star because I don't consider myself a rock star at all. I'm a total dork.
No, it's quite interesting. When you texted me about working with Bruce Dickinson, to me, is probably one of the top three vocalists. I love Iron Maiden. Iron Maiden is my second favorite band and so on. I was like, do you know their music? Like, are you going to play Steve Harris, which in my view, with all due respect to you, master, is Steve Harris is
phenomenal.
The ultimate yeah. bass guitarist. Unbelievable, right? But then you just had to learn those very quickly. And it's quite something because to me, as a gamer, as a video gamer, this means that you're not really interpreting music. Your music is natural to you. You would hear it, you would learn it, and you can just perform it, right? This is more of a talent, I would say, for most people. But the reality is it isn't. It's also when you said, but I went on performing live, and I was in bands, and I was in 7 bands at the time, and which is very similar to the story of the Beatles, if people remember how 8 days a week was the documentary, I think. It was basically that they played so much that they became so good at it.
I'm so innate to you, yeah.
So do you think there is this thing as, you know, such a thing as talent or?
It's a great question because I think, like, I'm humbled by this all the time with the people I work with because this particular group of musicians, and a lot of musicians I've worked with are highly trained musicians, especially when you're talking about,
yeah.
like, I mean, they've been through, you know, they have degrees in music. They read like machines, just things. I can barely name the notes that I'm playing.
Is that true?
I'm all ear. I mean, yeah. I can, but it's not like I'm always like, oh my God, this person is like this world-class, like maestro musician. But what they all have told me, which I'm getting better at taking the compliment because I have a hard time with compliments. So Irish people have a very hard time taking any compliment. We just deflect it immediately. But it's pretty funny. But like Maestro, our conductor in this, who is like, as far as musicianship and skill goes, he's like a god in musicality. And he's like, the thing is, you're such a natural musician, how you play. So I think all the years of playing with so many different bands and that type of like just grassroots, like ground training, what you're really learning is to work with other people and dynamics and listening, which is so important in music. So it's not my job to go in and be like, listen to me and turn everything up. It's my job to honor the music and honor, in my case, the bass part of that and the rhythm section part of that. So it's that ability to go in and be part of a team that is most often pointed out to me by other people I play, which is a little lovely thing to hear, because I'm a pretty modest person, so I don't want to, you know, I'm not looking for any like, wow, do you want to do a solo or more solos? I'm like, nope. I love my role as a bass player. I love it.
Tell me more about that. So my wonderful son Ali. So a few secrets. When I played the guitar really, really, really well. And I was like, everything I tried to do, I tried to be the best at it. And like you said, I did 4 to 6 hours a day, every single day for a very long time. And then my retirement plan, believe it or not, this is actual truth. My retirement plan was that when I retire the corporate world, I'm going to become a bass player. Right? I swear, why?
That's still the plan?
I'll tell you what happened, because I believe that the bass players are the most chill.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? A little bit in the background, but truly the backbone of any rock band, right? Yeah. And then my son, Habibi Ali, when he was 11, he came to me very apologetically and he said, Papa, I'm going to upset you. And I was like, what? Why? And he said, I'm going to steal your retirement dream. And so he chose to play bass. And Ali's character was so much a bass player. He was in the background, even though he held his band together, right? He really had mega input into the melodies and the music. So a lot of the music they composed, they were called Fox Hill 5. They did one album, but of course, you know, Ali didn't have enough time to make more. But they were very, very popular in Dubai. And he would be in the background. Even in the setup of the show, he's always in the shadow, right? But really holding the band together. And of course, Ali, being a hottie potati, as his girlfriends used to call him, basically was the focal point of the band doing that. But it does take a different person to choose to play the bass. You know, the lead guitarist, the lead vocals, is the guy that wants to be in the spotlight.
Want to be out front.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you don't come across as shy to me, but you're not hyper introverted, but
yeah, it's a balance of both, because now at this point in my career, obviously, like, for anyone that has followed it, I'm known for running with hair everywhere and love yes. music, just threads yeah. everywhere
yeah.
up and down, or because I'm usually playing wireless, so I'm, you know, running
yeah you're running around.
So I love being on stage, but that partially is kind of like your stage persona and your alter ego in day-to-day life. I'm just an introvert who's quite happy on her own reading a book and not being part of the
don't
party.
Don't say that. You're destroying the image of rock
sorry standard. Sorry to ruin it all, but anyone who knows me knows that, but it's funny. But I think, yeah, it does, because I love being a bass player for that reason. I'm still up there playing great music with great musicians, but I don't have to be up the front. I can come in and out, but I also just love the role of bass. I love rhythm. I love the foundational aspect of it. I love locking in with a drummer and knowing that, like, we've got the backbone of this, that no matter what falls apart, like, love that role. I love that kind of glue. And I can sit on it. I just love groove and I love riffs. I don't feel any desire to be extra flashy. Of course, every now and then the song needs bits and pieces, or like in Whitesnake, David Love's like, oh, you know, he's pushing you up to the front. And that's great. But the reason I'm drawn to bass is that more fundamental reason, and that just like,
sometimes it's just one note, right? You add one note,
you know,
the bass.
Or the power of one note. And obviously the frequency of it is just like, I'm so drawn to that low sub frequency. And that's why a lot, like, people always laugh and they ask, like, favorite guitar players, for instance. And I'll say Lindsey Buckingham. And he never comes up in the top list because he's not a shredder. And he's not like, you know, Satriani or Malmsteen, and who are all phenomenal in their own right. But I love Lindsey Buckingham because he can solo and use 2, maybe 3 notes and bring you to tears because of dynamics and just feel. And
feel, exactly.
Oh, so, yeah, that's kind of the long and short.
I think the interesting side of being a bass guitarist as well is that most people who listen to music don't actually recognize the bass. So I used to tell my kids when we would be driving in the car together, I would actually play a song and then say, let's notice the bass, right? And I think probably this is one of the reasons why Ali loved bass so much. But most people don't recognize the backbone. I mean, you know, it's really, really holding the song together.
But if it stopped, everything
exactly, would be, right? Yeah.
It's probably good. It's just you would notice fast if it was gone.
Yeah.
That's why I was telling you when you were playing Still of the Night when I came in.
Yeah.
Like that bass line is so phenomenal because it's an 80s mix. It's so buried in the mix that I really wanted to learn it and honor Neil Murray, who's a phenomenal player, and he doesn't get enough recognition in the bass world. But when I dug in and I like got the mids and the lows up in the mix and heard what he was doing, I'm like, oh my God, this is beautiful.
Yeah.
Like this is such a beautiful part. And the way that like it goes, because it's such a beautiful song anyway, with the bridge and the crazy outro, that when you honor it fully, it just brings it to life. And to be able to play that kind of like iconic bass lines with Tommy Aldridge on drums and with David Coverdale singing is, I'm like, how did I get here? Like, what's happening?
How did you get here?
I
don't have a lot of envy in my heart, but I have to say this is a beautiful place. I think especially the way you live it, Tanya, is a beautiful place. So an interesting, you know, maybe segue to what you're really all about, okay? So, of course, being the bass guitarist of Whitesnake, when you said, I'm going to be in London, let's go have a vegan meal together, I was like, yeah, I'll go with the master anywhere. So just one selfie, please, right? But then you're so, I don't know if the word is bothered, but you're so concerned with our world and where our world is. And it seems to me quite interesting because there is people of influence or people of following or people of, you know, status or power or money are the ones that can change the world. But in reality, most of the time you'd see that, you know, if you're successful in business and you make a little bit of money, somehow something happens in someone's mind and they just try to make even more money and even more money. If you're famous, you become addicted to fame. You told me, and I think that really, really got my heart, that this is your ticket, your pathway to be heard so that you can try to make a difference. Now, of what? What are you championing? Because you're championing quite a bit of things. Actually.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like, where do you start with the problems in the world? But as far as I'm concerned, my mission since I was a little girl has always been very directly correlated to animal welfare and with that environmentalism. But really all of that kind of umbrellas under just, we've just gotten so narcissistic as a human race. And so like exactly what you said, like the more sort of power and the more status that we get, and that might just be like a false sense of that on social media, it's like the less we tend to use our skills for good, which is frustrating. So as far as what I was seeing early on was, as silly as it sounds, but oh, if you're kind of in a band or you're a bit known, obviously you like more followers, whatever that means. It makes me so uncomfortable in a way. But maybe that you're not shouting just into an echo chamber. So if I can use this to sort of speak my truth per se, and my whole sort of life's work, I guess, comes down to the power we don't even know we have as consumers and as people, and what we can change like that if we wake up a little bit. So a lot of my mission is obviously directly related to veganism, plant-based, but I have a real problem with labels, and I think that it just immediately shuts doors. So
yeah.
I've been a vegan my whole life, although I didn't really know I was until I was in my late teens, because I didn't have a word for it. I just
I didn't know.
And I kind of wish I still didn't, because it applies to anything like politics, religion, your dietary choices, whatever. As soon as we start labeling each other, we immediately start to be in all these separate echo chambers, and that's just escalated, obviously, by social media. So it's trying to find ways to open conversations with everybody from all different walks of life on the simplicity of what we choose to purchase, what we choose to eat, has a massive, massive ripple effect on the planet. Because we're all hardworking, and every single dollar or euro, wherever you're from, is a vote. Every day, all day long, is choose to what we support. And if we support the wrong things, it holds them up. If we don't stand up and have a voice for the voices, and that can be people, animals, whatever. Nothing will change, but the world has kind of just come into this mass inertia.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's bizarre to watch, because I believe, maybe it's just to keep myself sane, I believe that people are inherently kind for the most part across the world. As someone who travels a lot, I meet endlessly wonderful people. Just
I believe that 100%.
Touring, traveling. But because of the way we've went in the digital age and the age of information, some great, and I love how you write about it. That's why I was drawn to your books. But we're also on this kind of hedonic treadmill, right? We're like, oh, anymore. But then we get there and we're not really doing any good with it. And we're just distracted more and more. So it's kind of like all the projects I do and all the posting or whatever is trying to simplify and just bring some normalcy to, hey, what you eat today, what you buy today, what you choose to click on, how you choose to react, you know, it has a massive, massive effect, not only on yourself, because all of the cruelty, a lot of the cruelty in this world goes on behind closed doors. So people don't, like in the animal rights world, I've been working in this since I was really young, and I've seen some horrible, horrible stuff so young. And I had to step away from it, like, because I was a hands-on activist. I was working in a rescue shelter for 10 years, and it's just like you're on a massive empath. I can't even think about it without, like, trying to not well up. But you're going, this is not right. So how do you find ways to show people who don't want to see it? Most people don't want to see what's going on in our food system, for instance. Like, this is where I choose to put a lot of my focus. So traveling and touring and being such a foodie, how, you know, fun it is to share. Look, it's great. It's so simple. Look at all this colorful, beautiful food. If you eat plant-based or whatever you want to call it, 1, 2, 3, 4 days a week, whatever you can get to, because it's like progress, not perfection. This is huge. This is not a diet fad. This is not a trend. This is it's a stance of I'm not okay with supporting this, because the cruelty that I saw hands-on, undercover investigation, animal rescue, if everybody saw it, you would drop your fork immediately.
Absolutely.
It's brutal. And violence out of sight is not any less violent.
So you trigger so many thoughts in my head about this. So I wrote a book early on, second book that I wrote. I wrote 8 chapters of it and never published it. It was called Understanding Fate. And Understanding Fate was a very, very, very highly mathematical approach to understanding how we end up in certain places. And part of it, I wrote about the reality of what is destroying our world. And the mathematics would blow you away, right? The mathematics of it's not the big polluters, okay? It's not the big harmers, if you want, that are destroying our world. They have big impact, okay? But there are fewer of them. It's the passiveness of all of us combined, okay, that we let certain things happen and just turn an eye to it. We just don't look at it, knowing damn well that animals are being cruelly, treated, that this is an industry where they are literally an SKU, a product, you know, treated with horrendous violence, where we day after day after day pollute our planet and add a tiny bit. Each and every one of us is like, it's not me. It's not me. I'm not going to fix it, right? Mm-hmm. Look at me. My impact is this much. But there are billions of us
exactly
with this kind of impact.
Yeah.
And the numbers multiply in a way that it is huge.
It's huge. And one of the most common kind of feelings and responses is like, but what's it really going to do if I go vegan or if I go half vegan or whatever? It's huge, because if everybody did that, or half of the population, or half, a quarter, it's insane. But I think, and I know you wrote about this before as well, and it's this whole thing of like hyper-normalization.
Exactly.
It's so big that we just can't even comprehend it. And it's all out of sight. And then we have all this very clever marketing and this very mendacious marketing, actually, which is very frustrating, because otherwise kind people, which is most people, are trying, like you see it, because I'm looking at labels and food with a very different lens to most people who are walking through a grocery store. And you're like, oh my God, it's just lies and lies and lies. So you
100%.
take ethics out of it. I know not everybody cares as much about pigs or little frogs or whatever it is as me. But we're being lied to as consumers. And that's frustrating as a person who works very hard. It's like so I have loads of friends who go and they're like, I buy only grass-fed, free-range, you know, whatever it is, cruelty-free, humanely slaughtered, the world's greatest oxymoron. Like, humane and slaughtered just shouldn't coexist in a sentence. Yeah. So, but that's because, you know, the marketing side of it has to speak to people. If you actually put on the package of whatever it is, cheese or meat, what happened to get it from A to B, not only has it an insane negative effect from the carbon impact of it, the waste of water, the weight of land, antibiotic resistance, you know, ocean acidification, deforestation, you name it, just because we want a burger, like, so they have to put all this flashy marketing. But that's also, like, I don't think that it's necessarily, oh, it's so nefarious, it's some evil empire. It exists because we pay for it to exist as consumers, right? If we shifted our consuming habits, then they will shift because they just want to make money. So the optimistic side of this in the work and the people that I work with on these types of projects, we already have the answers and solutions. I mean, it's incredible. We have like precision fermentation. We can have milk now that's not from cows. We can have meat that is meat. Cellular agriculture is here. But we're so attached just psychologically to how things always are and how like the food system has always been, that it's hard for people to shift to this new, because it's seen as a technology which can kind of freak people out. But now we've gotten, because we don't have time to fight about like everybody go vegan, everybody do this. Yeah. It's like you need the critical mass to shift. Is it like 25% of the population has to shift in order for something to become the norm? So we have all the solutions with all these brilliant minds and technologies here on front of us.
Yeah.
But we have to, you know, sort of wake up and understand we're being lied to every day on labels and just ask for better. Like it's not fair, because again, like I always say, take ethics out of it. I'm exhausted debating why we shouldn't be cruel to animals. It should go without saying. Just because something is smaller or weaker does not mean we should reign dominion over it. This is ridiculous. And until we treat our most vulnerable better, and that people and animals, like I just don't think we're going to get anywhere, because
you know, it goes both ways. So one staggering statistic is that now of the all of the animal mass in the world, is it 78% is cows and sheep, right? Yeah. So not only are we enslaving that mass amount of basic food for us, basically, we're also killing the other ones.
Totally.
Right? It's like, you know, humanity is so arrogant, but so dumb.
I know. Like, what at the same time, we're so brilliant, but so stupid. It's amazing.
Yeah.
But it's so true, because all our arable land is being taken up for mostly like fast food, factory, you know, again, back to this whole consumerism thing. Unless you literally have a farmer, you know, or you're raising and killing your own meat. And that's, you know, I have friends who are hunters and I have much more respect, because I'm like, I don't want to see it. I still don't want to kill animals, but they agree it's not okay to support this mass animal agriculture. And it's like 99% of meat comes from that. There is no way around it, because we are using, we're literally knocking down rainforests to either grow soy to feed cattle. Cattle can't eat soy. Like they're ruminant animals. They can only digest grass.
Yeah.
So we're not only clearing land to grow crops to feed animals who are then sick their entire lives, because by nature they're not designed to digest it. So we're now ingesting sick animals. So it's like you're not doing the best for the planet, obviously, your body. And if you saw what was happening and the math, as you would be phenomenal at, the math is insane and so sad.
It is really.
Like we are now feeding, because of byproduct runoff off, say, the fishing industry, and this is so screwed up, like cattle are fast becoming one of the biggest consumers of seafood. And
what?
I know, because the industries are constantly finding ways to cheaply feed and mass produce animals, because the demand, it's interesting, like veganism is growing and plant-based, this, that, and this, but it's also like meat consumption is growing as the human population grows. And that's terrifying, because now we're starting to see vertical factory farms, and that's like terrifying. And I always say, okay, back another reason, take the ethics out of it. We're going to see the end of antibiotics. Like antibiotic resistance is like just that far away, because we're pumping all of the antibiotics into the animals we eat. So suddenly, you know, we fall and graze our knee and get a basic infection, and antibiotics don't work. If you really want to scare yourself, look into the end of antibiotics, because we're just you can't expect any life, animals in these situations to be healthy because it's so unnatural. So we pump them full of steroids, hormones, antibiotics in order to keep them from being too sick until you kill them. And that's just screwing with antibiotics and like modern medicine development. So there's endless reasons. It's like we're killing the rainforest to grow the, and it's really funny because vegans always get this, like, yeah, but you eat all the soy. It's like this percent. All the soy is going into the cows. So if you really care about rainforest, you shouldn't be eating, you know, this beef from, and living in the US, it's so interesting because, you know, the bacon thing is a big thing. Like most of the bacon is not coming from where you think it's coming from. And it's not some cute like farm story. It's coming from some horrible, horrible situation. And it's or coming in from China and the food is coming in from Brazil or whatever. It's probably the most un-American thing you can do is supporting these industries because they're owned by overseas conglomerates. So there's so many reasons. And obviously I could talk about this for days, but the base is coming back to like, and a lot of the work that I try to do is just individually, although it's hard to change individually, it really does have a profound effect if you just make a little bit of effort. Like if you consciously consume different for a few days a week, it's pretty staggering because that sends a market signal that there's more demand for this and less demand for that. And then the system changes with the consumer because at the end of the day, they just want to make money. Yeah. And why wouldn't we want to live in a cruelty-free world? It just baffles me because, you know, Paul McCartney said it well, if slaughterhouses have glass walls, everyone will be a vegetarian.
So you see, I'm with you in terms of how far humanity has gone and that we will pay back for all of this for sure. I don't want to make anyone feel bad. So I do eat chicken occasionally, maybe 2 times a week and so, or so. And, you know, most of my food, I don't call myself a vegetarian or a vegan. I call myself a motarian. I eat what's good for Mo, but most considerate about what it is that I eat, right? Now, the idea of you showing up, because I think, you know, feminists are destroying the feminist movement because of how overboard they go. Vegans are destroying the veganism movement because of how overboard they go. But you, as you hinted in the middle of the conversation, you have friends who are hunters, you speak to hunters, you basically are saying, look, it's not a black or white, you know, if you're not with me, you're against me. It is a spectrum of we can have improvements on the way, right? Now, there is that blame that goes to vegans that sort of, are you trying to make me feel guilty? Are you trying to shame me? This is not what you're trying to do.
No, I believe wholeheartedly, you know, and it's we have so much more in common than we don't. But just human nature being what it is, we focus on the one thing we don't have in common.
I know,
and we forget. So if you take like whatever it is, a hunter and a vegan, and what are they going to focus on? You kill animals and you love animals. Oh, you listen to Zeppelin. Oh, your kid goes to school here. Oh, you know, I like plants. Yeah. Like there's probably 1,000 things you agree on and one thing. So I love people. I love travel. I love meeting different cultures. I love learning why. I love learning why not. I love all of that. So I think that it's just so much more powerful in whatever it is. And this could, you know, apply to politics. It can apply to anything. If we stop focusing on that one thing we're hell-bent on, because most people want to live more consciously, for lack of a less hippier term. And there does nobody any good to bombard anyone with your opinion. Because, like, you know, as they say, opinions are like assholes. Everybody has one. But it's like, I see it in the vegan movement. It's so funny. Like, I didn't know I was a vegan until I met a vegan when I was, I don't know, I think I was 17. And I met a guy in Dublin who was like the depiction of Jesus Christ, the long hair, like just essentially almost like levitated towards me. I was like, and he started telling me about the in-depth about the dairy industry. And then so for me, I didn't want meat. And then myself and my mom have like a same thing with this dairy taste sour. So I naturally didn't eat dairy. So I was just kind of an accidental vegan. So I get this label in my teens and I'm like, oh, I guess I'm a vegan. And immediately, you know, I'm looking for, and I was a full on activist. So frontline, like anti-fur campaigns, I'm barred from the fur shops in Dublin. I'm like, you know, out on the front line against all the, you name it. But I got that out of my system younger, thankfully. So I completely understand and empathize with the aggressive activism, because I know what it feels like and the pain of, like, why won't anybody listen when this is happening? Why is nobody looking at this is how, you know, fur coat is made, or this is where your pork comes from? So I understand the frustration, but it never really works in the delivery of opening people's hearts or minds. So you're better off focusing on common ground and solutions, which now, again, like, I just can't believe here we are in 20. If you had told me when I was a teenager that A, we'd even have decent veggie burgers, let alone be able to literally grow meat.
Oat milk.
You can get up and oat milk.
Here. Like, oh my God.
People are like, how do you milk oats?
You.
But you. Every morning on the tour bus, guys.
Yeah,
every morning.
Oat milk. Yeah. And honestly, I mean, like, I never understood how I drank milk after I had oat milk.
It's so much nicer. When we look at, like, I always say milk is a funny one because, you know, I grew up, as most of us did, where in school you're like, they're trying to force feed you the warm cartons of milk because that's where you get your calcium from. And you're like, oh, I don't want to drink this. Gross. But, like, we are literally, we're the only mammals that continue drinking milk after we're supposed to be weaned. So, because it's a huge industry. And what people don't, you know, because if you just look back a step at a time into, like, why these things exist, like, a lot of times as an activist over the years, people are like, but why dairy? Like, how is that cruel? Because did you know in order to have milk, they take the baby calf away? And I know some farms will always debate me on, well, we don't, or we don't do for a certain time, but just, like, take the ins and outs out. You have to have a female cow lactating in order to have milk that we can consume, which means continuously impregnating a cow who gives birth, and then you take the baby away so that the humans can have the milk. I mean, when you just break it down and look at it, it's pretty weird. And then not only that, another industry pops up off the side of that, which is veal, which people are like, oh, how's that related? It's veal because the baby calf is a byproduct. And then they're like, oh, if we put them in enclosures and don't let them move, their muscles stay soft, and don't let them have their mother's milk. And then it's some, like, luxury meat, veal. We're like, just to step back and look what it is. And I know people have a hard time hearing a lot of this, like foie gras. Are you kidding me? Like, it's just insanity what we do as people, but it gets a fancy name. Why is it called veal? Why is it not called, like, completely neglected baby calf meat? Why is foie gras got some fancy French name? Like, at least label it what it is, you know? But again, it's, so I also like to use humor because I like taking the piss out of myself. I'm an Irish person. I have no problem with, like, being what we'd say, like, slagged. And, you know, as you know, I have this show coming out now, Highway to Health, and myself and Derek, we really want to play into that because we've been doing this our whole lives. Every joke, every prod that's been ever made, we've heard. And we want to kind of question the status quo. We want to push and have fun with it. And we don't want our guests to all be vegans and think the same. That's boring. We want to look at, A, why people can, if they are vegan or not, like, what, how they got there. We also want to talk to people who are behind these incredible innovations. Like, it's the future's right there. I can see it. Like, Sarah, why aren't we all looking at this? So using our platforms, which music gave both Derek is a singer of Sepultura. So Brazilian heavy metal band for any who do, really heavy. When you hear him sing and then you hear him talking, you're going to be like, is that the same person? So Derek's also like a lifelong activist, basically. And he's a big old dude, so it's great. So we're really having fun because our personalities both work in that sense that we can have those middle ground conversations. We're not going in as, like, spearheaded, like, this is the answer. I have all the answers. I'm right and you're wrong. That's ridiculous. I don't have, we all have blood in our hands. It's impossible to live in, like, if we have phones, we have blood in our hands, you know. It's so impossible to live a fully cruelty-free life. But why, if we have the skills and the knowledge, do we not live in the least cruel way that we can by just reading labels and looking a little further into what you're buying? Because if you buy it, it is holding up an industry, as are subsidies, which is a whole other spiel we could go off on. But people ask for change, or when you become the change, and it's a little frustrating because we live in this kind of what's the word? It's almost like it's activism, but it's like a performative activism on social media where everyone's like, be the change you want to see in the world, but then continues to do exactly
It's hard, Tanya. Like, you know, if you like cookies.
I like cookies. I just eat vegan cookies.
You know, if you like certain cookies.
Yeah.
I'm saying this not as a joke. Like, you know, I can tell you, I would probably have a six pack if I didn't like my cookie with my coffee in the morning. And I know that my belly is cruelty to others. Like, you know, people shouldn't see that.
I don't think cookies are causing that much harm.
I'm not. But it's, and I think the point I'm trying to make is that people find it hard to change. And one of my unforgettable experiences is I watched Seaspiracy.
Phenomenal.
I'm like, and I watched that, and I watched, what was the other one that was talking about the fish and the birds ingesting plastic? And, you know, there are so many good, good documentaries that are basically talking about how we are affecting the world. And I think the message to me was very straightforward. It wasn't, look, I'm going to change the world. I don't think I will. Even in my own mission, 1 billion happy, at best, I'm going to affect the lives of a few millions or tens of millions of people. I'm not going to change the world, right? And the trick is, do I want to be the one doing that to that, you know, poor fish? Do I want to be that one? And if you suddenly, one of my turning points in my life was when I was grumpy as a young, aggressive business executive, and I hurt my daughter, basically, with my grumpiness. That was the moment where I decided, you know what, I really need to invest more in my happiness. It's not that difficult when you make the choice, but you had to have an incentive, right? Now, in a very interesting way, I think I don't want to be the one that is causing animals to be treated that way, okay? And it's a choice that I make, at least because I'm human and I have protein needs and I have, you know, I'm traveling sometimes, I don't have access to all the food, whatever, right? I can give myself a million excuses, but at least consciously every time, you know, one of the things I do is every time I would order chicken, I would eat every single part of that poor thing. At least, you know, I honored that, you know, she gave her life for me, right? Now, the thing is, it's that incremental tiny bit of move that I think makes all the difference. And if people have that incentive that I am the one causing that harm, yeah, an arm's length, but I am the one that's causing that harm by buying that thing, maybe people will start to find enough incentive to change.
Well, that's the, like, making just that more direct connection, because that's what's happening. And outside of just animal agriculture, like, you're just paying someone else to do the work that you would never do.
Yeah.
And you're right. Like, that's what we do as humans. We make excuses and it's too hard to change. It's too hard. But at the same time, like, we have it in us to run marathons and climb Everest, but we can't not eat a piece of meat. Like, I think we can make that decision, but it's so ingrained in us culturally and food is part of our identity. But that's also, like, such a great, powerful tool of nowadays. We have these amazing documentaries, What the Health, Seaspiracy, The Game Changers, you name it. Like, it starts to get in your head more and more, and the information is there, and then what you do with it, obviously, is your choice. It's unfortunately not the animal's choice. It's also the people working in these situations. Like, it's so complex. It's unbelievable because you can really dive into the fact that this is a human rights issue as well. Because as someone who worked very, very hands-on in these spaces, we've, you know, interviewed workers in factory farms and in slaughterhouses, and the amount of human rights violations that's happening is shocking. Yeah. Yeah. So again, as a consumer, whether or not you really care about animals, that's not always the case. It's so bad for the planet. It's so bad for the people working there. It's obviously not doing us any good health-wise. I've been alive my whole life without meat. The protein thing is an industry. Protein is a strain of amino acids that your body doesn't care if it comes from nuts, seeds, soy, vegetables, starch, or meat. It just recognizes it when it comes into your body and it needs it. I'm not here to debate nutrition because it's not my expertise, but I am a lifelong non-animal eater, alive and well.
Running on stage.
Don't supplement. I don't take anything. Yeah. And I've kept check of my bloods and everything over the years. And as, like, a kind of walking advocate for you can be alive and well, because people get very concerned. They're like, where do you get your protein? It's like, I'd be retired if I had a dollar for every time someone asked me that question. But where do you get your protein? Like, we literally, the world is suffering what doctors call, like, a massive, the fiber gap. People don't get enough fiber. We're not talking about that, because protein was marketed as this very, very important thing, and it must come from animals. And animals get their protein from plants. All protein comes from plants originally. So it's so interesting that, again, we just, I mean, modern industrial farming and animal agriculture just became so big so fast that it kind of got out of hand. And now we're at a tipping point with the planet where if we don't change or start to look at not just animals, like even how we crop the land, like monocropping is destroying our lands. And there's, again, there's all these beautiful technologies happening and all these amazing, amazing foundations and groups doing work that's like, here we can literally have utopia and not have food insecurity, which is the other bizarre thing. Like, we waste so much food in the process of keeping these antiquated systems alive. It's really frustrating, because when you look at how much it takes to, you know, grow a cow to its slaughter age to get X amount of meat, like all the water, all the grain, all that, and then you're destroying the land. There's people hungry in these, the places we're going, growing the crops, instead of giving crops directly to the people. We're shipping them so we can have cheap meat the far side of the world. It's just so out of whack. Nobody in 2023 should have food insecurity. That really, really grinds my gears. Nobody should be hungry, because we are throwing, I mean, I can't remember the last time I checked the stats, it was up on the 40% of food. Like, it's very high, like, of how much we waste. It's shocking. We shouldn't waste 1%, let alone be in the 30 or 40 percentile of food wasted, because we've just become so used to having everything like that. We live in an Amazon Prime world, like, no offense, Bezos, but it's, everyone got too used to that. It's like, I remember when I first moved to the US, and the difference of, like, I grew up in a small town in Ireland, and I remember you would go to the little grocery store when I was a kid, and on a Monday, they would have the shelves full. And then by Friday, they'd be kind of empty. And then on Monday, it'd be restocked again. And something that really stuck out when I first started living in LA was you go to like a Whole Foods or whatever, and it's just constantly perfect. Yeah. It's like a movie set for vegetables. Yeah. Like, how is this possible? We're just in this, we just want all the time. Just like, it has to be perfect and on demand. Whereas, I mean, in an ideal world, obviously, we would try to grow more of our own food, try to be a little bit more self-sustainable. But even just a step up in consciousness as consumers is so, so powerful.
Yeah, I have to bring us back to that idea of, it's not only possible. I think most people don't realize how enjoyable it
Absolutely.
Is. I mean, you as an advocate, rock star, like, you're a rock star, but half of your Instagram is basically, it's basically food.
It's just food.
Right? So my personal experience, so this is the month of Ramadan in Dubai. And, you know, in Ramadan, I tend to keep a very minimalist diet. I attempt very hard. So the spiritual significance of Ramadan is that you get to feel the need of others, right? So you get to feel that others actually don't have food every day. They don't have water every day. And believe it or not, it's quite an experience, because the idea of 30 days of fasting, the first few days, it's like a little bit of intermittent fasting. Mm-hmm. It's good for you. You feel healthy. Yeah. Everything's wonderful. It's, and especially because we fast and don't drink water as well. By day 20, your body goes like, holy shit. Do people live, like, there are so many people in the world that are so poor, right? That are below the poverty line. They have one meal a day. Not by choice of fasting, mm-hmm. right? And suddenly your body goes like, hello. Mm-hmm. Like, suddenly empathy surges through you. Like, I am not relating to another person feeling what they're feeling. I'm feeling it. Mm-hmm. I know what that is. So I try to really mimic that experience. Every year, I've done it for, you know, since I was 8. And part of that is I have a very standard diet. So I eat almost exactly the same soup every day for iftar, for breakfast, as we call it. And it is vegan, you know, style, Asian flavored soup. I eat it exactly the same way every day. And what will shock you is this. I go out twice a week and I buy a carrot, a broccoli, cauliflower, like not a broccoli, like a bit of broccoli, a bit of cauliflower, a box of mushrooms, and, you know, tiny things that cost nothing. And they last me 3 to 4 days. Fresh, enriching, wonderful. Like, really, I feel nourished. I feel amazing. I feel light. And it's an enjoyable experience. It's not like I'm forcing myself to eat something that is horrible, because the reputation of, you know, vegan food is like it's cardboard flavored with a little bit of Himalayan salt, right? That's not the truth at all, you know. After that, I have my wonderful oat latte. I make myself with oat milk, and I'm like, how did I ever drink milk? I mean, honestly, after a week of getting used to oat milk, you go like, what was that taste in milk? So weird, right? And I'm not, again, I'm not like you, I'm not an advocate for anyone to change their diet aggressively, but I'm asking people to also explore. If there is an alternative that's better for the planet, that has less cruelty, why don't you give it a try, right?
It's, and food is humanity's greatest uniter or divider in certain debates. But it's so true. Like, it's another real misconception of like vegetarian, veganism, plant-based, whatever you want to call it. Oh, that's like, someone said to me recently that is a privileged diet. I was like, well, for starters,
hold on.
Veganism is a social movement.
Yeah.
It's a lifestyle. Veganism to me is like everything, reading your labels. I don't want to use products that were tested on animals. I choose not to wear leather, blah, blah, blah. But plant-based whole foods is a diet, and it is not expensive. I am an independent musician who's been touring her whole life. There's like, I'm an artist. I'm not a multimillionaire. Mm-hmm. I've been living on tour buses and on low income since I started. It's not expensive to eat whole foods and plant-based. It's not.
Probably cheaper.
Obviously, to some people in the world, anything is expensive. But as far as like the Western working world is concerned, it's not expensive to go and buy a head of broccoli, cauliflower, carrots, make a soup, you know, lentils, one of the most, beans, chickpeas, all these the most incredibly nourishing foods that go way back to ancient times, being so, are cheap and accessible everywhere. And if I can do it as literally an eternal nomad, anybody can do it half the time even, you know what I mean? Yeah. And I think that because we have, and it's great that we have all these cool foods that come in, like we vegan burgers and we vegan cheese and we vegan, and that's fun and it's a novelty. And I say, great, transition food. That's not what anyone in the plant-based health world is advocating. It's simple. It's your healthy whole foods and whole grains, which is accessible and affordable to most people. Yeah. And it's that getting it out of your head that it's expensive or it's some, I hate the word diet. I mean, it literally has the word die in it, which is not like, it's ridiculous. Like, you know, from following any of my stories, like food everywhere, color, like eat the rainbow. It's right there. The food tells you this is good for me. Mm-hmm. It's like, if it's this, and I don't mean like, you know, injected colors and dyes, but if you have a plate full of different colors, you know, that's your multinutrient right there. You don't need to be taking all these supplements and all this. It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
But we like to overcomplicate things as people. Like, and I think we like to label ourselves, and, you know, we like to be in these, like, I'm a this and I'm a that. And I mean, we're just all humans, and we're at least like, we can't necessarily change the world. But back to your point on Seaspiracy, you can change the world for that one fish or that whale. You can change the world for the animal. And by sending that message, it might seem so big that it's impossible, but it's happening. And that's what I try so hard to stay optimistic in a world where you're seeing like ridiculous behavior that we do to animals and why we do it. And we come up with 1,000 excuses why this is all how we always did it, whatever. Yeah. Why don't we just do it a different way and celebrate that? Because now we don't even, this is what I get so excited about, because we don't have to fight anymore about this and that. We have now figured out how to have essentially a utopian food system for everyone. Now, granted, some of it's an early stage, scale up is a whole other thing. But if the consumer supports this positive shift, and it's not some like Franken meat. I wish people didn't have such an obsession with, oh, I need to have meat. So we had to then develop how to literally grow meat in a lab. You can just eat whole foods. But, you know, people are attached to meat, and that's fine. Now we have it. Taking out all the cruelty and the waste of land and the waste of water and the thousand things you could spiel out. So like, why wouldn't we all start heading in that direction? Because it's beautiful.
It happens only when the economic model is aligned to it.
Yes.
So I have one more thing to add to this, by the way, which is not about the type of food that you eat, but something that I would encourage our listeners to also think about is the source of the food. Okay, so I'll mention this and then we talk about highway to health. So one of the things I do very, very attentively in a supermarket is, I mean, I love New Zealand, but I wouldn't buy an apple from New Zealand. Okay, I love South Africa, but I wouldn't buy a mango all the way from South Africa. If I really crave a mango and I'm living in Dubai, then India is a closer transport to get here.
Yeah.
And I don't think, again, people realize that this whole globalization of the market of food from one side is making us eat food that is stored in ways that are actually not natural at all. That apple that you're eating has been picked, you know, weeks before. Potatoes that you eat might have been picked months before because shipping is cheaper that way. But at the same time, all of the pollution that results from that entire shipping line is just unbearable, honestly, for the planet. Now, let's talk about highway to health, not from what you're attempting to do, but how are you able to do this? You're touring all the freaking time.
I haven't been off the road since I met you in London.
Exactly. Like, so when do you have time to record this, to film it? And why did you make the choice to put it on YouTube and not go to Netflix and others?
Those are all very good questions. So, yes, I am pretty much on the road all the time for one project or the other. It is very hard to juggle because both Derek and I are touring musicians, but the project itself comes from just pure passion. The whole team, like my best friends in Dublin or the production team, everyone surrounded by it, everyone who supported it since the beginning is what you call like mission aligned. So that foundation that it's not some egocentric thing where Derek and I are like, we want to have a show and we want to be the hosts. That's not what it's based on. So that is a great start.
I think it's the opposite way. It's basically we have followers. We want to give them
totally. And
to
I was
think
joke
about.
with John and Lucy and our team. It's like I don't even want to be on it, but like
I know what you mean. Yeah.
But it's been such a wild ride because we started filming about I want to say 6 months, 4 months maybe before COVID hit and the world like shut down.
Yeah,
and
you told me. Yeah.
So before that, it was all like, you know, a lot of R&D, like what are we doing, developing the idea, raising funds, getting the team together. And there was a year or so of that, maybe a year and a half of that. And then it's like, okay, we're ready to go. We have the team, we have enough funds to start this. And we hit the road really hard. And I basically just tour manage it. So I take everyone's schedule.
Like you manage all the other tours.
Because I'm just, I don't know, a lunatic. But it's like, okay, here's everybody's passport details. Here's everybody's schedules. Let's line them up and see where we are. You know, the biggest thing being like, where's Derek with Sepultura? Where am I with whatever band I'm with? And find little pockets and then reach out to guests in those regions. So we tried to really have guests that were relevant to where we were. So this week we just put out some stuff with Cleo Perez, who's a Brazilian superstar. And, you know, when we were in Ireland with the Happy Pair, of course.
Oh,
and,
did you? Oh, yeah. I love those guys.
They're the best. I was so glad when I saw you because I was going to connect you and then I saw you post. I was like, oh,
yeah.
No, the souls always find each other.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say the best thing about this slow-mo thing is I meet the nicest people. Oh, yeah. And I tell you, they are sweet, sweet people. Like, they're really wonderful, very special, very kind.
We have that episode
coming
out
soon.
Yeah, that'll be out in the next few weeks.
They're 100% aligned with you, huh?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember, like, coming across the Happy Pair, Steve and Dave, if you know them. The lads, maybe 5 or 6 years before I moved from Ireland to the US and started really heavily touring because... For the longest time in my life, I felt like I was the only veggie in the village. Like, I'd never met anybody else because it wasn't really a common thing. There wasn't, you know, many other veggies around. So I started hearing about their work over the years and, you know, it came from such, again, this thing like we're trying to do with the show, just a pure place. They want their community to feel healthier, so they open a fruit and veggie shop. And then this, like, empire just started to happen. So, of course, I get to know them because, you know, people find each other like little magnets. And they're just great lads and how they use their platform. So one of the things we wanted to do on the show as kind of an explainer as to who and Derek and I are, because not everybody knows or not everyone's interested in the music. So we went to Cleveland, where he's from, and we do a little episode in Cleveland, even though people think he's Brazilian because Sepultura are Brazilian, but he lived there for 20 years and speaks fluent Portuguese, but he's from Cleveland. He's from Shaker Heights. So we wanted to do a home story. So we went to Ireland, to my hometown, to talk to my parents. That's, and of course, so while cool. we were in Ireland, we went to the Happy Pair. So that's its own episode. But to your question, yeah, managing it is interesting and madness, but I love it. Like, I thrive in chaos.
Maybe that's one thing we should change.
Then, well, but the chaos is all truly stuff I love. Like, I get really, really excited about even the idea that it could change anything or something, or just one person's world, or because we get lovely messages. We just started the channel. So we decided we film intensely, and we have 22 terabytes of footage from around the world. Okay. And I was just saying on my Instagram the other day for people to like bear with us, because at the beginning it might seem like a couple of nice sit down meals with people we know, and we're chatting about plant-based, and we've Kevin Smith and we've Kat Von D and all these like names. But really, the big view of it is so hard to explain, because we do everything from, like, we were on board with Sea Shepherd doing an ocean conservation episode. And we were with Ford Motors talking about solutions in the automotive industry. Like, what, like, really is, like, electric cars a thing? We want to kind of prod into everything. Material innovations, like future materials, like taking animals out of the material chain. Precision fermentation and future food technology. Like, we want to go everywhere, because it's kind of all connected, right? But we decided to do the YouTube model in the end, because after all this filming and getting stuff, we were starting to get offers of these, you know, mainstream media deals. And I always go with gut instinct. As far back as I remember, the moment that I refused meat, I had the same feeling when I left school. I had the same feeling with music. I had the same feeling with these deals. And we were seeing contracts and people come in that were like, oh, this is great, and we can give you this and we can give you this. But what they were really wanting to do, which is just the nature of the beast, is to own the IP.
Exactly.
They don't really have, this is a mission aligned project, as hippie as that sounds. It's philanthropically funded to, as far as we've got it. The team are people who just are doing it for all the right reasons. Nobody's here to be like, I want to be on TV. Not at all. So the more we thought about it and the more we looked at these mainstream offers, the more we realized that they just want to own it. As crazy as, like, they want to own merch and bands we're in, all this ridiculous stuff into perpetuity, and we may release it next year or in 7 years. We're like, no, this needs to go out. So when COVID happened and the world, whatever that whole 2 years was, it was just madness. It's like we did a lot of the editing, and we were getting ready to release it in that TV format. And then we were just getting the heebie-jeebies with all these agents. And I was like, oh, I don't know. They don't. Yeah. It just doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
We have enough of a platform, not that we're megastars or anything by any stretch of words, but we have enough of a decent following and passion that why don't we just do this ourselves?
Yeah.
Because it's the age of the digital creator. So we're like, let's chop it up a different way. So we went back to the drawing board and we took the 14-minute, one-hour episodes and we started slowly hacking them down into tens of hundreds of shorter form videos. We're like, fuck it, let's just put it out.
Are you not going to put the long form as well, or?
Maybe, if that's what people react to wanting. We're truly testing the waters to see where it sits. And it's been like, the team were laughing at me the other day, because talk about having to just give up control, which I love to manage and control the project and make sure everything is in order and make sure everything is perfectly aligned. There was a lovely just sense of, let's just put it out.
That's see what happens. To do. Yeah. I had the same experience when I was writing Solve for Happy, because publishing industry, very, very little known, but they're dictators, I think, in a very interesting way. So not my current publishers. I love my current publishers. But when I started originally, there was my very first publisher on Soul for Happy insisted that my book would be written in a language similar to Deepak Chopra, right? And I adore Deepak. I had the chance to meet him and you know, he's a humble, wonderful human being. But I'm not Deepak Chopra. Right? And my first book was very, very personal to me. It was Ali's story. It was my son, and I wanted him to be written in a certain way. And my role opposite to most mystical you know, well-written, spirituality-driven books was to write a book that was to be understood by 8-year-olds, right? And so literally the rule I gave to the editors is if it cannot be understood by 8-year-olds, it's not going to go in the book. And that tug of war, basically, and I see you're doing the same, because in my choice, eventually, my choice was, look, I don't care if I get the support of publishers and sell a million copies or, you know, not get the support of publishers and sell 10 copies. I just want to sell the right 10 copies, mm-hmm. right? And that basically, I think, is what you're going through. I heard this before. I heard the idea that the industry will take something and say, we'll publish it within the next 7 years. Which is, you know, for someone who's as passionate, I don't know if you notice what happens to you when you start to talk about veganism. Oh, you should watch this video.
I never watch interviews myself, so that's funny.
No, it's quite interesting, actually. So when you were talking about music and rock and so on, you were very chill, laid back, telling stories.
My job,
and so
on. Yeah? Which I love.
and then when we started to talk about animal cruelty and violence and veganism, you leaned forward. Okay, and you started to speak faster.
Oh, wow, sorry.
And like bullets. Right. So clearly, we know that this is very, a passion project for you. How do you? Yesterday we were talking about. Yesterday I took Tanya to an Egyptian place.
It was amazing.
I think it's the origin of veganism, honestly, because
the
peasants of Egypt that were building the pyramids and so on only had access to vegetables and, you know, beans and so on. So our core cuisine in Egypt.
And they were building very heavy structures. I think they were getting enough protein.
They were doing fine. Yeah. Yeah. But the original Egyptian cuisine is mostly vegan. Yeah, actually, maybe vegetarian because I think milk was included, but very, very small amounts. Anyway, so we were talking about the fact that you're after Brazil. You're going to have a break.
Well, you were telling me I should take a break.
Yes, exactly. What's happening with that? So what happens when you're not touring?
The next idea comes into fruition.
There you go.
Or it comes into fruition while I'm on tour. I mean, the thing is, I am usually go, go, go. But I truly am passionate. And I love everything I do. So I do find it hard to totally stop. Because even if I'm physically in one place, my mind is in 42 other places. So
how do you get all that energy?
Whatever you just pointed out is it comes from a source of passion. And I think, well, the short time we have here on this planet, it excites me to at least try to be part of a positive change. So I think that is my charging. And sun. I need sun. That's why I left Ireland. I love Ireland and I miss Ireland, but I need sunshine. So it's, you know, it's partially weather and partially just the excitement of, I love connecting people and I love connecting dots. And that's why travel is so great because, you know, I meet someone like you and then I have a friend in this whole other industry and another friend. I'm thinking, wow, if I could bring these people together, we could have the most incredible think tank in the world, which we were talking about last night. But to your question/point of slowing down, I don't know. I mean, this is slow-mo. You tell me. You're like challenging me to take a break. You're right to sit in contemplation. I think I do that more than it may seem because I become quite the like solo nomad on tour. Even though what people see is lights and stage and people every night, I'm very much a loner outside of that. And I think I do a lot of my self-contemplation and thinking and being on my own on the road. So when I go home, I sometimes switch back into work gear, even though I've just come off work. So I don't know how to answer that.
So the deal I asked Tanya to contemplate yesterday, and I'm going to ask all of you to do that sometime, is when you go home, keep a notepad next to you, and whenever you decide you want to do something, write it down and say it will be done in 2 weeks' time.
I told my friend this morning, and he said, "You're going to spontaneously combust."
Exactly. But I find that to be quite interesting, actually. So I separate the doing and the being with a notepad, and I simply sit down and I tell myself, I know there are lots of things to be done. And, you know, I'm a doer as well. I wake up and the minute I wake up, I'm doing things. But, you know, sometimes I tell myself, I had this very unusual series of things breaking in the last few weeks. Everything I attempt to work on sort of resists a little. And I was asking a person who's very, very dear to me, and she said, maybe the universe is sending you a message. And the message clearly is, maybe stop
trying
doing.
To fix stuff.
Yeah, stop doing for a while. Because, you know, if my aquarium is wonderful and I love my aquarium, but I want to make it extra perfect by adding A, B, and C, if I don't add A, B, and C, nothing will break. When I start to add A, B, and C, things start to break. So I separate. When I decide to do that, I separate the doing and the being by basically writing down what I'm going to do and then slotting them in the right moment of my life. Having said that, I can definitely not blame you for the passion, Tanya. I think it's what gets us close, you know, makes us close, and it's what I adore about you. And I encourage everyone listening to us to actually go and check out the YouTube channel of Highway to Health. While you're doing that, listen to ACDC's Highway to Hell. And and follow Tanya's work, whether her music or her projects. It's always been a joy for me to see all of the fire and the passion trying to make things different. Yeah, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
It's a wonderful conversation. And for all of you listening, don't do what Tanya does. Slow down every now and then, because it doesn't really matter how busy you are today. There's always a tiny bit of time to slow down. I love you all for listening, and I will see you next time.